Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to Zubon for June 23rd, 2013. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. As always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Hello, welcome from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, well, we've got a big show tonight. Our first guest is going to be Charlie Harper of Peach Pundit and also writes a column throughout that's published throughout Dora. Charlie's been on many times in the past, but hadn't been on in a few months, and so we thought we'd get Charlie on, and Charlie is so timely, I'm pretty much welcoming him from the top. Welcome, Charlie.
Good evening. How is everybody tonight?
Oh, good to have you on. Well, Charlie, let's start off talking about just, you know, races in Georgia, since that's where Peach Pundit's base is, even though you probably could talk about any of our states. But looking at Georgia, there's a U.S. Senate race, and the Republican half of this race is loaded. I mean, you've got, what, three sitting congressmen. You have a lady that held statewide office and was, I guess, the party runner-up for governor. There's also some more candidates on the Republican side. Charlie, why is it, you know, garnered this many candidates when there's going to people are obviously going to lose congressional seats, and as if the election was held today, who'd come out of this thing as the winner?
Well, the first part of the question, why are there so many candidates? I mean, the U.S. Senate's often referred to as the most exclusive club in the world. If you're in politics, it really is kind of one of those highest things you can aspire to do. And frankly, a U.S. senator has a lot of power. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do as an individual senator that you frankly can't do as a member of the House of Representatives. The rules of the U.S. Senate allow you to exercise personal privilege in a way that really does allow you to, if you want to have one, have a what we'll call personal agenda. And so, you know, it's a nice prize, for lack of a better way of saying it. And when you have a time period like we do, I mean, there's still 13 to 14 months from the primary. When you know that there's going to be an open Senate seat in what should be a relatively safe Republican state, again, that's not to be taken for granted, and it does appear, you know, Democrats are going to contest it at this point. But realistically, Georgia, in an off-presidential election year, if the Republicans nominate the right person, you know, it should be a Republican seat. And so, yeah, there's three folks willing to take a risk that they may not go back to Congress to get to a position they think they can be more effective and frankly, is more prestigious. You, again, as you said, have Karen Handel, who used to be Secretary of State, has a statewide organization that got her within 2,500 votes of the Republican nomination for governor just 3 years ago. You know, she, in my mind, also a very credible candidate and is one to watch. And then you've got a couple of other folks that are kicking the tires, and, you know, at least two that are very close to entering the race, it looks like, both who are going to be able to self-fund at some level, but neither with any political experience. And those are always the fun ones to watch to see if there's really the ability to get a campaign going versus is this someone, frankly, is this a consultant's project to make retainer as well as the commission to go along with running a statewide race for someone that they can convince has a shot at getting something like this. But, you know, in most cases, U.S. Senator is not where you get on-the-job training. And, you know, I think the four that, you know, we mentioned that are the three congressmen plus Karen Handel, you know, really if you, you know, had to say where it was going to, you know, who the winners are going to be today, you've really got to look at that group. And all the polls at this point show them fairly close. You know, Jack Kingston, by virtue of not really being in the Atlanta media market as much, is a little behind the other three who are kind of bunched together. I don't really see that at this point as a big detriment to Kingston. He seems to have a good organization with him. He's got, I believe, the most money in the bank, but he's also going to find out how expensive it is to buy name ID in the Atlanta media market. But I don't really anticipate that being his biggest obstacle going forward. And, again, with 13 to 14 months, all of those four, plus, again, probably one or two of the others, are going to get a decent look. And, you know, as the wonderful cliche goes in this business, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And as we had in the 2010 governor's race, we went and had the campaign. Everyone thought they had it figured out from their angle. And several months in, the candidates actually changed, and we didn't have the same race later that we did at the beginning. And so, you know, it's definitely one to watch. It's going to keep all of us that are political observers entertained for quite some time. And, you know, the dominoes that go through it, the number of contested congressional races that we have. We have the same thing, you know, in terms of a large number of candidates going for safe Republican seats in Georgia 11, Georgia 10, Georgia 1. And, you know, we'll also have a fairly wide, probably contested primary in Georgia 12, where Congressman Barrow will be defending his seat. But thus far, much like I think the Democrats at this point would say they probably didn't get their marquee candidate to go statewide in the Senate race, I'm not sure the Republicans have found their marquee candidate to challenge John Barrow in what was originally thought to be a heavily Republican district, but one that he managed to defend pretty soundly the last election cycle and got a pretty large percentage of the vote in a district that he wasn't supposed to be able to win. So, you know, lots to watch in Georgia politics over the next year plus.
Yeah, I don't necessarily want to move off of the U.S. Senate race, but for some reason, Georgia Republicans, maybe other than Max Burns in Georgia 12, they seem to not pick the best candidate, I would say. But that's probably a show within itself. Catherine, questions for Charlie about the Senate race in particular.
I have a kind of a minutia question to ask. Now, these congressmen that have declared that they're running for Senate, did they all? So, have they resigned their congressional seats?
No, in Georgia.
So they don't have to do that until they qualify, right?
Well, they don't have to resign at all. I frankly don't know if the state law even applies to federal offices, but Georgia's resigned to run law, that again, I don't even think applies to federal offices. Pretty much says if you're running for a position that the term begins concurrent with the office you currently hold ending, you don't have to resign to run to law. It would really only resign to run really applies more things like mayor running for, because a lot of the municipal
right.
elections around the state, including like City of Atlanta is the big one right now, that will have off-year elections in an odd numbered year. And so those terms don't end concurrently usually with the state legislature, statewide office, congressional terms or whatever that are all in Georgia done on even years. So that's really where resign to run normally comes in. But in this case,
If come, you know, like, say, before qualifying, if one or two or three of the congressional representatives that are running now decided they didn't want to run, they could just decide not to run.
In theory, yes.
Okay.
You know, the problem you'll have is you'll have folks that will have been running a campaign for a year in those districts, and then you've got to figure out if the incumbent, you know, do all those people just go away? Does it become a primary challenge? Because, again, in each of those districts, you're likely to have four or five folks. And so do all four or five go away? Do they all basically say, okay, now this incumbent's just proven he's just a career politician? I mean, while it can be done, I would say I don't look for that to be done, but this is politics. You could always be surprised, But yes, they're a congressman up until the point of the swearing in of the next Congress. And if they so chose at qualifying in, which I believe will be April of 2014, roughly, what is that, 10 months from now, if they so chose, they could go in and qualify for the office they currently hold instead of running for U.S. Senate if they decide things didn't quite break the way they wanted. I, again, would say I don't necessarily anticipate that happening, but I've learned
it could happen.
You really don't rule many things out in this lifetime anymore.
I know that's right. That's the only question I have. You were very thorough. I appreciate that.
We aim to please.
Go ahead, Tim.
All right. Good evening, Charlie. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Tim. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. Let me throw some names out there at you. Saxby Chambliss, Johnny Isaacson, Governor Dill, and the Speaker. Do any of those four people get involved in this race at all?
Well, I guess you'd first have to define what get involved means. You know,
endorsement
quietly.
Are behind the scenes. Let's give you a wide range of options.
Yeah. endorsement, I would be surprised if the Speaker or the Governor made an endorsement before the runoff and certainly before qualifying. Mm-hmm. In the mood of the electorate that you have today, those two people will be on the ballot this time. You know, the Speaker mm-hmm. in Georgia runs as a state rep, for those who are listening from other states. So he has a two-year term, as all state reps do. He'll be on the ballot. The Governor is on the ballot this time and may face a primary challenge of his own. But, you know, realistically, it's smart and good politics for them to publicly be neutral, and I would expect them to be. I don't really think Senator Isaacson, it's generally just frankly not his style to get involved in things like this. And so, again, I wouldn't expect to see an endorsement, and I'm not even really sure you're going to see him working real hard behind the scenes on it. Senator Chambliss may have a little more interest, but, again, I don't think it's so much Saxby himself, but you know, each of those people that you just mentioned has a political apparatus. And the mm-hmm. question then becomes, what do those people do? And that's where the behind-the-scenes comes in, where I do think you'll see the political machine of each of them at some level push some buttons behind the scenes. And that would probably be a little more obvious from the Governor, who clearly has a very large, statewide, very effective machine. But again, I just, at this stage, what I'm hearing from behind the scenes is, you know, he's going to stay out of it at least for now, mm-hmm. but may reserve the right to get a little more active. But I still don't anticipate a public endorsement, at least at this stage of the campaign, in a runoff where it's really just two people, as well as the fact with all those people then, assuming they have secured their political future for the next term, have a little less to lose of picking between, you know, two people as opposed to picking, you know, diving into a crowded field and upsetting the supporters of the many other candidates all at the same time. And so mm-hmm. I don't, you know, on a blanket statement, I would be surprised to see any of those four make a public endorsement before the general primary. Behind the scenes, I think you're more likely to see, again, probably of the ones that you mentioned, I think you'd probably be most likely to see Saxby's folks and the Governor's folks, possibly a little bit of the Speaker's folks, but, you know, again, whether that's really being directed by them or just the fact that the folks that work for them on the political side are political animals, and
mm-hmm.
We do what we do.
Yeah, but in the Governor's particular instance, Charlie, he's sporting a 72% approval rating and a disapproval rating that really just almost does not exist.
That must just be me. That's what I figured. That's just me.
What do you think,
for the readers out there that are not aware of the polls
yeah.
he's referencing, that is GOP primary voters, so they did not
yeah.
call Catherine and ask for her.
Oh, name. They didn't ask me. Okay.
but at least behind the scenes, don't you think he might be tempted to take that 72% out for a spin and see what he can get with it?
The thing that you've got to remember, again, for I think your audience tends to, shall we say, not agree with me and my GOP friends on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
The mentality of a GOP primary voter right now is very anti-incumbent, very anti-establishment. Those are the folks, the activist crowd. I'm not really, you know, I'm still trying to figure out how pervasive that is and if that's just, frankly, the folks that are showing up at meetings or does that really go deep? And I'm talking about folks that are angry with our own party, not just angry at government or, you know, wanting, you know, the small government, reduced government crowd. I mean, that's a large part of the party, but the folks that are really anti-incumbent, even against our own incumbents. And this far out of a primary, it just really doesn't benefit either of the two of those four that are going to be on the ballot this time
mm-hmm.
to risk inflaming that possibly small but very vocal and very active crowd to weigh into a primary. It's just not good politics. on their side, mm-hmm. and that's why I would just not anticipate, despite the fact that, again, within the GOP primary circles, you know, deals approval rating 72%. I don't anticipate that changing, but I don't really know what the upside of the governor getting involved is to risk that at this point, mm-hmm. and to possibly make it more competitive. So, mm-hmm. you know, he's basically been relatively smart on this politics as he's been governor. The approval rating doesn't happen by accident. I don't think you necessarily decide, as George W. Bush once famously said, I've earned the political capital and I'm going to spend it. I'm really mm-hmm. not sure this is what you spend it on, especially mm-hmm. when there's still a whole session of the legislature, you know, that he's got to get through before we even get to qualifying. I mean, there is time and place that you can spend your political capital, and I just think it's way early. Let me put it in this term. If the governor was going to spend that capital, I think he would have tried to do it as the congressmen were all jockeying for position before they all announced.
Yeah.
And I know they all visited the governor, right. And he didn't, you know, he basically told them individually, you know, all three of the Republicans he served with in Congress, that he wasn't going to take sides. So
yeah.
it really does kind of just become bad politics on his part at this stage of the game if he chose to change his mind on that. Again, as it gets closer, I'd expect you to see them get a little more active and at least tipping their hand as to what their personal preference is. But in terms of an active, this is my candidate at this stage of the game, I just don't see it.
Okay, well, primary night comes, and I'm sitting down here huddled up with members of the media, as I'm prone to do at the county courthouse, and we're watching returns come in from around the state. And you know the major candidates in this race. This candidate or that candidate has a region that they run strongest in. Who's more likely to get their region out to the polls?
Again, I can draw scenarios, and I do in my own mind, where any two of those four, the three congressmen plus Karen Handel, could be
mm-hmm.
in the runoff at this stage. And, you know, while I kind of called the governor's race early, and the mistake that I made is I kind of put the candidates into brackets where I
uh-huh.
had candidates going from the, what I would call the establishment wing of the party versus candidates coming from, shall we say, the now we might call it the Tea Party wing, but the more activist, anti-establishment, you know, whatever you want to call it. You guys probably use the term fringe. I don't like the term, but I think you get where I'm going. And I thought there'd kind of be one candidate out of each. And what I really kind of missed in my call on it was that Governor Deal actually picked up support, significant support from both sides. And ultimately, I think that's really the battle that you have going on right now is, you know, Paul Brown definitely has the constitutional true believer, just vote no crowd behind him at this point. You know, that's
mm-hmm.
enough to get him in the polls pretty much around high teens to 20%, depending on which poll you look at.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, frankly, that isn't his high watermark, but we'll see. You know, I think what you're going to ultimately have to see out of the successful candidate that, you know, wins the entire race, it's the candidate that can pick up the older line, not exactly hardcore, what the Tea Party would call the squish vote, but those people that are a little more pragmatic but still need someone that they can lead, but still acceptable to the people that want, you know, the people that pound their fist on the table and say that it's just the principle of the thing. You're going to
mm-hmm.
have a section of both of those groups ultimately figure out which candidate they can support. And we've still got 14, you know, the trick for these candidates right now, there's almost certainly going to be a runoff. I can't
uh-huh.
see a scenario where there's not a runoff, where somebody coalesces
mm-hmm.
50% plus one vote. And so what they have to do is now run a campaign for more than a year, and they have to position themselves so that when they're in a runoff, they have the right message to beat the random person that is opposing them in the runoff, that they haven't boxed themselves into such a corner over what they've done. And we frankly don't know what the top issue is going to be on voters' minds in late July and early August of next year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a real runoff strategy problem. And so to try to pick who it's going to be at this point, you know, everyone's got to kind of chart their own strategy, figure out what they really think is going to be important. But the things that are being, you know, if you go to a GOP meeting right now, you know, we're talking about Common Core, which actually originated here as a state's initiative, but now it's become the product of the devil and various things like that. I don't think that's going to be the issue 12 months from now. And so you've really got to kind of figure out where's the voter, the general voter's mind, or the primary, but general primary voter's mind going to be in July of next year, and try to build your entire campaign around peaking at the right time with the right message that gives you an advantage over one of the other people that you're going to ultimately have to be in a runoff with. That's not easy to do. And a lot of, frankly, a lot of luck is going to be involved.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, with that, I'm going to throw it back to David for some more topics. David?
Oh, Charlie, it's easy. You either hate the IRS or hate the Obama administration. That's going to be the top two issues in the Republican primary. Has been for a few cycles now. It'll be at least one more cycle, and then it'll be the new Democrat to hate.
How do we manifest those themes? You know, that's really what, you know. You know, if we're running against the IRS, we win. Y'all know that.
Yeah.
You know, well, if you guys are trying to make the IRS sympathetic, you have made our work easy for us.
No, but I just know that that's what Republican primary voters, that seems to be a oldie but goodie, if you will. Well, let's talk about the Democratic side of this race. Right now, the Democrats have Dr. Bronco, Rad, and I don't want to maul the man's last name. And then another
Dr. Rad, that's what he goes by.
Dr. Rad, okay, Dr. Rad. And, of course, we've heard rumor after rumor about Michelle Nunn. Now, everybody says, well, this race could be very competitive if a candidate like Michelle Nunn or John Barrow runs. John Barrow's not, so at least it's Michelle Nunn. Unless Dr. Bronco is, Dr. Rad is better than we think. Looking at it from the other side of the aisle, what does this thing look like, Charlie?
And I think there's a third candidate that we were also not aware of until we ran Dr. Rad's announcement. And I think, frankly, he should take a page out of a former Democrat turned Republican's book, and we should just start calling him Bubba. But
I can't remember his name.
He ought to be a witness protection primary
online.
Well,
at any rate, you're going to have a primary. I mean, even back when Republicans were in, no one was ever going to elect us statewide, we still managed to field three or four people in a primary, just entertain ourselves, apparently. At the end of the day, it goes back to, again, where is the voter's mind, and who do the Republicans nominate? And that's why the Democrats have to nominate a candidate, because if we allow our primary to take our positions and spin ourselves out into orbit and ultimately try to outflank everyone on the farthest part of the right, to the point that, there is a center of gravity of Georgia politics, and it's to the right of center of national politics. But if we take it so far out that we can't bring it back to your average voter that will show up in November of 2014, I would remind my Republican friends that Senator Chambliss ended up, having to go through a runoff to retain his seat just a few years ago. Now, granted, that was a presidential election year. Turnout models were different. There's a lot of things we can say will be different this time, but we can't take for granted that ultimately the senator's got to be able to reflect where the majority of Georgians are. And the Democrats need to, frankly, in my opinion, keep that in mind, too, when they're selecting a candidate. That was one of the reasons, I think, from what I was understanding and hearing, again, I realize what I'm usually told is what y'all want Republicans to hear, but, that John Barrow, who, if you look at the press releases I get from him on a regular basis, he's right down the middle. I mean, he's choosing his issues very carefully because he's in a Republican-leaning district, and he picks issues that are pragmatic. He doesn't really get involved in so much the wedge issues. It just, puts the bread and butter issues on the table and kind of comes at it from a right down the middle, dare I say it, common sense approach. And if the Democrats could pick someone that's able to do that versus the Republicans that might have someone that is still running a primary campaign, if you will, after the primary is over, you could be competitive. But if the Democrats pick someone that is aligned, shall I say, with more of the National Democratic Party than what used to be the formula for a successful Georgia Democratic candidate, then it's going to be a lot easier for us. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it's, regardless who we nominate and who you guys nominate, the candidate that can appeal to the vast majority of, you know, the majority of Georgians anyway, is going to be who's successful. And I would think Democrats need to take a long look at, you know, how does the message that you have play to a Georgia, you know, outside your own sphere of influence. I mean, that's frankly what, when I go and speak to GOP groups, I'm having to remind our folks that is that, you know, we only seem to network amongst ourselves these days. And if you really want to remind yourself what a general election looks like, you know, we got to talk to some folks that don't look, act, think like us and listen to the same radio stations we do if we want to remember what it's like to try to actually convince voters to vote with us, because I think we're getting a little rusty on that.
Yes. Well, let's move over to the other big statewide race, and that's the governor's race. And Tim alluded to Nathan Deal's high approval rating in the on the GOP side of things, obviously. And so I want to stick with that since, once again, the Democrats don't even have a Dr. Rad in that race. But David Pennington seems to make move after move looking at this race. He's the mayor of Dalton. He's talking about how conservative he is, even though he seems to be a champion of, say, public education, because every picture you see of him, he's in front of the Dalton public schools. Does David Pennington really have a chance in the GOP primary, or should he run as an independent to have a better shot?
Georgia's ballot access laws are so strict that anyone running as an independent really, that's just almost a practical impossibility. I'll just say
yeah.
it that way. You know, he could in theory run as a libertarian to get on the ballot, but from that doesn't, I don't think, help him at that point. But honestly, I don't think David Pennington is an independent. I think he's a Republican. The problem is that the Republican primary is set with an incumbent that has a 72% approval rating. And, you know, as I referred to it kind of last week on my blog, that's generally what I refer to as tilting the windmill. You know, if people are open to a change, then, you know, David Pennington has a great record as mayor of Dalton. He's got some good ideas, but people have to be open to listening or even understanding why they want to hear your ideas before they're going to agree to buy you as a candidate. And I don't see how he is successful at this point. Georgia is a very, you know, we're almost a closed system, if you will. And if the incumbent's got a 72% approval rating, you might have the best idea, you might have the best track record. It just doesn't happen. And so as someone who's been very, you know, anti-establishment in my writing career, if you will, and tried to open up doors where there are, I'm also very pragmatic. And, you know, I just don't really see that there's a path to victory for him on any trend line of how I see things going from here until primary day.
Yes. Well, it just seems to me that this fellow, he seems to really want to run. He obviously does not sound like he's a Democrat, but it just doesn't look like this is the year to have the opening in it, but he seems bound and determined to try it anyway. And seems he has a bone to pick, if you will, with Nathan Deal. Well, Tim and Catherine, we still have Charlie for a few more minutes. If you have more questions about the governor's race or other questions with Georgia politics, ask away, Catherine.
Go ahead, Tim. I'm thinking.
Okay, and I do have other questions about Georgia politics. You know, Charlie, that some states' parties have gone over to a convention to select party nominees as opposed to primaries. And it is my strong opinion that your state committee made a wise decision yesterday by basically slapping that idea right down. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. On this, we can agree. I've written about it. I think the idea of allowing what is by definition the establishment to wrap themselves in the label of we are the grassroots, as if the only grassroots are people that will sit through our convention, for those that are not aware of the process, is to sit through four Saturdays in four consecutive months to go through the process to get to be a delegate at the state convention, and to pretend that only the people that can give up four Saturdays like that and go to the expense of paying a fee to attend each of these conventions to then be one of 2,000 to 3,000 party insiders, but to consider yourself the grassroots against the establishment and then somehow believe you can project your opinion better than the voters can in the ballot box of who a candidate should be, I think is just ill-conceived. And it was, you know, frankly, as I've referred to it among some of my friends, and I think in writing at least once, it appeared to be an interesting alliance between the what we'll call the Liberty Caucus that has been making inroads within the Republican ranks because, frankly, your average retail voter just won't give up the time to be part of this process, which is, frankly, a closed process. But if you're determined enough and you have a core group, as they have been,
Charlie,
you can make
your signal maybe kind of getting weak here and there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
At times.
Okay.
I hear him perfectly.
Yeah, I do too.
Go ahead,
okay.
Charlie.
Yeah. Well, I was just basically saying
yeah,
that,
I know if we're hearing
I,
Charlie's signal. I know he's outdoors right now. Charlie, if you get a chance, let's see if your signal
David,
is stronger.
You are,
we'll
David,
we
David,
can hear him
you're
perfectly.
Talking over Charlie.
Well,
he,
Charlie
he's
was
coming in perfectly.
Okay, let's try again.
Yeah.
Hopefully you can hear me now. But
I hear you perfectly.
I think what we had of those pushing this idea were some of the – frankly, the insiders that felt they needed to be rewarded for their willingness to go through this, I won't say ridiculous process, but definitely time-consuming process, along with some of the younger folks that have found that because they're willing to invest the time, they could probably get the nominees that they can't get when they try to run them in front of the voters. And luckily, the state committee pretty much ended that talk on Saturday and said, we will not go forward with it. It would have required legislative change as well, and frankly, Speaker Ralston had also said he was not in favor of it. And so I think it was probably something that was not going to happen regardless, but at least the Republican State Committee on Saturday pretty much said no to it. So I think we can end talk of taking away primaries and having Republican insiders pick our candidates for us.
A wise, wise decision. Catherine?
Well, this brings me to a topic that I'm always interested in discussing, even though I don't think it's going to change in the near future. I am in favor of closed primaries, where you register in your party and you vote for your party and not for you can't just switch depending on what your mood is at the moment. What do you think about that, Charlie?
That's something I could be more open to. I frankly haven't studied it at a really high level. You know, we've got, of course, in the Republican Party, we definitely have an influx of folks that are card-carrying libertarians that like to get involved in our primary process, knowing full well that they're still going to support whoever the libertarians nominate. And frankly, as we've become the supermajority party, we've got folks that, you know, frankly are Democrats that are coming over because that's the only place they can influence. You know, ultimately, it's going to be a Republican that's elected. Democrats are going to come vote for us or vote for those nominees because in a lot of cases, they don't have anyone to vote for in their primary. And so, you know, if you actually have your party's people nominating, it might help both parties articulate a little better of who they are and what their candidates stand for. The mechanics of how you really do that, I'm not sure ultimately how that happens. But
Yeah, I come from a state where it was like that. It was closed primaries. You registered as a Democrat or a Republican, or you could register, you know, not register for a party. And if there was something on the ballot that wasn't partisan, you would just vote for that.
And like I say, I think that's a less drastic change than what we're talking about. And I think
it makes sense because I think the whole idea of a primary is for the party to pick their candidate. And if you get – because we've always heard about these – you know, like I had some friends who switched and voted in the Republican primary against Ralph Reed because they didn't want him to be the lieutenant governor. And then we always hear the stories about Democrats in DeKalb voting against – going in and Republicans in DeKalb voting against Cynthia McKinney. I think it's sort of like, you know, anecdotal at best. But it is always a possibility. So
yeah.
I'm in favor of that. I'm not in favor of what your I don't want to call them fringe either. What they were trying to do at your
well, it was a resolution that was presented, and again, by the time you know, in the We adjourned our convention without considering resolutions because we no longer had a quorum because we ran our convention until almost 7 p.m. and it only planned for lunch. There were no food vendors. The vending machines were out. And so people were bailing as soon as we elected our officers. And that's the way it should be because the resolutions that we presented, most of them did not pass the state committee once they got the kind of scrutiny they needed because I won't go into it in the time we had. But for especially for a resolution like that, it's not something that needs to be done at 7 p.m. when you've been in a convention hall since 10 a.m. People are hungry. People are tired. And they're really there to vote. And frankly, we had not even seen those resolutions presented in writing because they pretty much came out of resolution committee straight to the floor for a vote. And that's not how we want Congress running. That's not how we need to do the voice of the party. So we put each of the resolutions up on Peach Pundit. People had time to debate them. Either there or, you know, on their own, the state committee called a meeting. They considered the resolution. I think they passed a couple of them, but most of them were defeated. One was tabled for further study. But
the
ones to replace primaries, we basically said, no, that's not an idea that we're willing to entertain. So I'm pleased with that.
Yeah, good job. Okay, David, back to you. Are you there?
Yes, I am there, and trying to get Charlie's signal better, what have you. I think I lost for a second. Well, Charlie, we know you're an outdoor event today, and you were gracious to spend as much time as you did with us. We'll have you on again in the future, but until then, enjoy your cookout.
I appreciate it. Thank you
all.
Thank you, Charlie. And y'all have a great
evening. Thank you, Charlie.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Charlie was quite gracious to even come on. He had an engagement but managed to squeeze in just about half a show with us. In the meantime, so once again, we appreciate Charlie Harper. Well, let's talk about some other stuff, and let's bring it back to some Georgia Democratic politics since we use his expertise on the Republican side. And the DPG, they finally decided an election date, which is going to be in mid-August. And some candidates have already started coming across. Catherine, you actually visually found the clown car graphic to put your story right, at least one of the candidates that's come up. I don't know if this is actually in your photo, if that's what you were that good, or just a
metaphor.
Oh, no,
metaphor, that was just a stock photo. That was just a stock photo of a clown car.
This gentleman that's really thinking that the Federal Reserve should be one of the top issues for the Democratic Party in Georgia is not in the clown photo, then I'll tell you. Catherine, the articles, obviously, you've probably put more thought into it than we have. Who's running so far? What is this race shaping up like?
Well, the only two candidates that I know for sure are planning on running are this Cantwine Stevens, who's from Athens, who was the chair of the Tea Party Patriots of Athens most recently, though he claims to always be a Democrat. He believes there's some crossover in the Tea Party ideas and the Democratic Party ideas. I had a hard time really nailing him down on that, but, you know, whatever. And Mary Squires, who's a former state senator, and she was a candidate for U.S. Senate in 2004? And then, or was it 2006?
She was four, and then she ran again. Just
she ran for insurance
3 years ago,
right?
For,
right.
Insurance
for insurance
commissioner.
So she has
like
a lot of
more recent.
No, it was in 2010.
But she ran for insurance commissioner. That's why it seems like more recent on her Senate run because there are two separate runs, but she's been in the spotlight. Yes.
Right. I'm pretty sure it was 2004. Well, whatever. It was when Cliff Oxford and Denise Majette and, I mean, that was another clown car. But anyway, so those are the only
two candidates. Better clowns than this Ken.
Those are the only two that I know of, and I believe that neither of them are eligible.
Eligible to serve, yes. And we'll get into that. Now, Tim, I've heard that Athens is one of the most liberal places in Georgia. Is it just so liberal that the Tea Party are Democrats there, or is this guy just a little confused?
That's a good question. I don't know, but of course, Athens is a liberal island surrounded by a sea of red. I tell you what I want to do, guys, about this race. And you know, the race is all about the rule, you know, and we know what rule we're talking about. And here's what Jay Bookman said. That is one stupid rule, and it plays right into stereotypes about the Democratic Party that its enemies love to perpetuate. The rule gives the party no defense against such charges because, well, it's stupid. It's stupid in intent, stupid in design, stupid in its execution, and stupid in its impact. Is
now,
that right?
Tim, to be fair, we do have more listeners than you're giving us credit for. We're into the thousands most weeks. So just to be safe, folks, the rule we're talking about is the interpretation is that you have to have a diverse group to where if you have a male in the first vice chair spot, you need a female in the chairs or vice versa. You also have to have, if it's a race that has 20% or more of the population, they have to be represented. And apparently when Mike Berlon stepped down, we currently have no white executive committee. I'm sorry, not executive committee, but no white
officers.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
So that's what we're talking about is people's interpretation is that we would have to have a white male because Nakima Williams, the vice chair, who is not running, Catherine, you told us that. So she won't.
Well, even if she was running.
Obviously. Yes, you'd have to have a white male according to interpretation, which, of course, you know, when you're having all these offices run at one time, it may not seem as limiting as it does in this case, but I think that's why Tim's alluding to the fact it may just be time to just have elections and see what happens. It could
well,
be that we still have a diverse group of people.
Let me clarify. I quoted Jay Bookman, and I asked the question, is what he said right?
Well, here's the thing. This is my opinion. You know, I tend to think that all these rules are pretty stupid, but the fact is they are the rules.
Right.
So it doesn't really matter if the rule is stupid. The rules are the rules. This is not the time to change the rules in the middle of, you know, an election just to favor someone who's, you know, pitching a fit.
Mm-hmm.
The time to change the rules is when we have a full set of officers, when we have a state committee that's engaged, when we have a bylaws committee that's functioning, then they can take that up in the normal course of the work of the party.
Mm-hmm.
But now is not the time. I mean, this rule has been in place for as long as I've been involved in the state committee, which is about, I was on the state committee, I don't know, about 6 or 7 years since I've been on state committee. David, now
mm-hmm.
you were on long before that, and this was the rule then, too, as well, right?
Yeah. The rules have always been this situation, if you will, but it's never manifested this way because you never had a chair resign. I mean, typically your chair is committed to and able to serve their entire term. Now, sometimes
right.
you have this with the vice chair of constituency services or some role like that, which usually, in that case, it's not going to matter as great on their race, their gender, because they're not one of the top two offices with the DNC slot.
And also, the other piece of this that I think is legitimate to sort of think about is that the first vice chair was not, it's not her fault that Mike resigned.
Mm-hmm.
So why should she
No,
there's a lot of people that are saying that she should resign so that we can have an open election. Well, why should she give up what she's worked for, the election that she won fairly and squarely, so, because Mike Mike chose to resign? It's not really fair, right?
Yeah, I see where
I
agree. That then it would change the rules a little bit, but then given that this is for, I guess, completing his term,
exactly.
which his term has how many more years? Does it have two
it's
more
like
years?
It's
a year and
the end
9 months.
A year, about a year and a half. Yeah.
Year and a half.
The end of 2014.
So that's one important thing to remember, that if this person wins, then they could do a great job and then win another term in, you know, of their own.
But it could just be that this is a 1 year and few months stopgap situation. Yeah. To really get us to where we need to be is talking about elections that really matter. Because yes, go ahead, Tim.
I was just going to say, you know, I was on the state committee nearly 20 years ago. It was the same rule was in effect then. And I understand, and we're all party activists. We understand the nuances of this thing and pretty much agree on all of it, I think. But my worry is, what about the average voter who picks up the newspaper and reads about all of these troubles? What are they to make of them?
Well, that's why I'm kind of, you know, I love Jay Bookman. I usually agree with him on almost everything, but I really kind of have a bone to pick with him on this because I think that the focus on, you know, the focus on the fact that it's a white male is really not the point. The point is we're focusing on the rules.
Mm-hmm.
We're following the rules that are not just our rules. They're filed with the Secretary of State. We have a legal obligation to follow those rules. And frankly, during the term of the previous chair, many of those bylaws and rules were ignored. So
mm-hmm.
for us to then say, okay, well, we didn't like it when he did it, but let's just ignore the rules now. My other question is that I would pose to anyone who challenged me was something that one of our commenters on Blog for Democracy made, which I thought was really, really important to consider. If the reverse was the case, if Nakima resigned for some reason, or the first vice chair resigned for some reason, would we force the chair to resign so that to ask the chair to resign so that we could have a fair and open election for the first vice chair? I don't think we would.
Oh, probably not, because that's why in most any organization, the top job is the prize. But then in that case, African-American female would have a easier road to then replace Nakima Williams should she resign.
Right. Do you think people would pitch a fit if we said only black women can run for this election if it was the vice chair?
I'm sure you hear complaints both ways because a lot of times people think about themselves, and if whatever decision helps somebody, they like it. If it hurts somebody, they don't like it.
Right.
Which this one, if you were thinking about, I would like to be the DPG chair, you probably should have been thinking about this for next cycle because you had no idea that Mike Berlon would have some type of legal trouble with his job that would cause him to resign and all that. I mean, really, the bigger issue is the future of the organization. Now, let me kind of pivot on another thing off of this. Since all this has happened with Mike, have y'all heard about anybody interested in running for governor? Have you heard any movement with Michelle Nunn since this started nearly about 2 months ago? Have y'all?
Well, I don't think it's been 2 months. But what do you mean since discussion of Michelle
close.
Nunn?
Well, can we round up? Yeah, I mean,
yeah, sure, whatever. My understanding of the situation with Michelle Nunn is that she has a lot of work to do to tie up her position at Points of Light, and that she can't really step into the race until that's all taken care of. She, from what I gather, rumor has it that she's in Washington, D.C. this week at a conference with the Points of Light, and that, you know, an announcement, it will come sometime, you know, soon, whatever that means.
So you're saying that this mess has not impacted her decision in a negative way? I can't imagine that all this mess has helped her in any way. I mean, got her more.
You know what I think?
My
I
fear
think
is people decide not to run for races because of how disorganized
Honestly, I don't think that the people who are going to run for governor or the people that are running for U.S. Senate place any importance on the Democratic Party of Georgia anymore. And that is a problem.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was quoted
as
a
And that is because of the last 2 years.
Yeah, by our newest statewide candidate, he said he's not going to run with the machine of the Democratic Party. I would correct him in that. A machine down there at all. It's too dysfunctional to be called that at this point. But speaking of that, apparently there's two candidates in the U.S. Senate race. One is Dr. Branko Radulovicki or Dulavaki. He is Dr. Rad, of a Yugoslavian origin. Now, he's actually got a website. He seemed to have announced that he was running, put together a little Facebook page with announcements and what have you. I mean, he seems to be something like a candidate. Now, there's another fellow that, Catherine, you said you couldn't even figure out his name or couldn't remember his name. Apparently, his name was posted in a comment on a Peach Pundit article because he's filed a committee, yet he's not let anyone know he's running. One of the strangest ways to announce your campaign I've ever seen. What do we make of these two candidates, Tim?
You've got to be kidding me, right? That's what I make of those two candidates. If Michelle Nunn's in the race, it's a competitive race because she can raise a king's ransom in money, therefore can self-finance and go, and she is who she is. You know, her father is Sam Nunn. Otherwise, it's not going to be a competitive race. All the competitive race is going to be on the Republican side of the thing. I mean, that's just it, right? I mean, you know, a blind man can see that. You know,
yeah.
I'm sure these are fine men that are talking about running, but, you know, there's no way.
But here's the thing to think about. If, let's say Michelle Nunn decided not to run and Dr. Rad was, the candidate left, he would run. He would get 40% of the vote in a general election just because he's got a D behind his name, a million votes. He'd get more votes than all but one of those Republican candidates when all is said and done. The one that won the general election, or the one the primary nomination, get more. But the number two person, which is probably a sitting congressman, maybe Karen Handel, one of those folks, this guy would actually get more just because he had the D behind his name in a state the size of Georgia. Isn't that kind of crazy to think about, that we're sloughing him off? But if nobody runs, just like if he ended up running for governor now, listen, nobody runs for governor. He says, hey, well, I don't want to face Michelle Nunn. I'll run for governor. He'll get 40% of the vote against Nathan Deal. Now, Nathan Deal could still get 60 and beat him by 20 walking away. He'd still get a million votes. Isn't that kind of just unusual to think about?
Well, you know, what if this guy, you know, I don't know the man, what if he turns out to be an Alvin Green type candidate? You can kiss your 40% goodbye, right?
Well, to be fair, Alvin Green never got his, you know, doctoral degree in medicine. I mean, he never had
Dr.
Rad a little short.
But a doctor in Texas who happens to be an OBGYN and a member of Congress waxed poetic this week about, you know, embryos masturbating or whatever. You know, just because you got that degree doesn't mean, you know.
But I mean, Alvin Green. And once again, Alvin Green, he somehow, but with a D behind his name, in South Carolina, a smaller state, still got an amount of votes. Probably didn't get a million because the state's population is smaller. But that's just something to think about. The DPG, the sooner that is straightened all out, the sooner we can get back to candidate recruitment, and then if we get candidates helping them win.
Here's another thing. It's why it's so important for Michelle Nunn to win or to run. Maybe we can steal the Senate seat if she runs, because nationally, we don't need to lose six seats, and we're going to lose some seats, and there's not many opportunities for a pickup for national Democrats in these Senate races next year, and all of a sudden, Saxby Chambliss announces he's not running again, and this race falls right into our lap. So if any of you out there know Michelle Nunn, hey, right, Catherine?
That's right.
Yeah, but
it's important, David.
But I think it's going to be such a tight race that win will be so tight that you have to have kind of a synergy with a decent, if not good, governor's candidate. I think we've talked about before how sometimes, and like in 2002, you know, Max Cleland and Roy Barnes, they ran real close to each other. Their races were run completely separate. They involved separate issues. But at the end of the day, there was not that many crossover voters one way or the other. I'm sure there's a few, but pretty much a lot of people voted the same way. If we have no or a dog candidate for governor, it's going to hurt her. So that's something that's going to have to be looked at. And the state chair, the new state chair, is going to have to, you know, go in and try to find somebody to fill that role. Well, we got some more different states to talk about and not a lot of time. Let's talk about Mississippi. We hadn't discussed Mississippi in quite a while. This past week, they had four mayoral races. Apparently, the Republican Party in Mississippi put a lot of effort into trying to win some of those mayoral races. I'm sure one they really wanted was Hattiesburg, not just because, I guess, that's not where the college is, but it's a larger city. But Johnny Dupree was the governor's candidate, or the governor's nominee candidate for the Democratic Party last time. And I think the Republicans thought, well, if they knock him off in his own city, in which we have nothing but just glowing reports of, his time in office when we had people on from Mississippi, I think people thought, well, you know, we knock him off, we'll show the Democratic Party. Well, he won, and so did Connie Moran in Ocean Springs. Two mayoral races were all won by the Democrats. Even though, you know, some cases these things are nonpartisan, we don't consider mayor's races the same as statewide races or district races. Catherine, how big a deal was this?
I thought it was a big deal, and bravo for the Mississippi Democratic Party for doing all that work.
Ricky Cole's the state chair. He had been the state chair. He came back over and was the state chair again. I believe we've had Ricky on the show before when he ran as agriculture commissioner, a friend of the show, but I know he's kind of taken back over there. And, if he can build upon this or at least hold the line some other places, it'll be good. Tim, what would you make of this?
Yeah, well, you know, it was mayoral races, but victories are victories. And perhaps it does show that, I don't know, for the first time in a long time, or the first time in this century, I guess, Mississippi Democrats are starting to get their act together a little bit. And perhaps also the Republican Party is getting a bit complacent over there from years of total control. Perhaps we should keep our eye on Mississippi and take the cue from them, huh?
Well, it looks like that Mississippi's actually doing better than Alabama. Mike could even say better than Georgia, probably better than Louisiana.
They've got. Well, I know they got one statewide constitutional officer. We don't have any. You know, so yeah, they're doing better than we are. They're working.
Well,
you read that article. They're working.
Well, one thing that you know you can say is against Mississippi, or you can say it's for Mississippi. Mississippi's the only southern state, only Sun Belt state, not gaining in population. So it's not like they can go, oh, well, if these people move in or these demographics change, it'll all be better. They just have their situation, and they have to work from where they're at. Sometimes I think that's a benefit. You just can't go, oh, well, check down the road, things will take care of itself. Now they got to go out and work. Right, Catherine?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that here in Georgia, just over the last couple of months, there's been a lot of talk about the changing demographics, and there seems to be a little bit of a sense of, oh, well, we'll just wait for the demographics to catch up. Well, it's not going to be that simple, because the Republicans know about those demographics too, and they might just change their, you know, platform to welcome some of that change in demographics.
Yeah, and same thing in Texas. Georgia and Texas are a lot alike in that way. And, you know, 2-4 cycles down the road, it might be great, but it'd be better to put the work into that and then, you know, synergize with that other effect. Well, guys, this has been a show. I want to thank Charlie Harper again for coming on to the Kudzu Vine. And until next week, it's been the Kudzu Vine.
Thanks,
guys.
Good night.